Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Susan Wilk, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Christopher Allen Miller. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
The fundamental fairness guaranteed by due process and the right to equal protection bar the state from depriving someone of his liberty solely because of his indigency. In this case, Mr. Miller was found to be a suitable candidate for SOSA. He was in perfect compliance with every condition of the sentence that was imposed by the trial court and the additional condition that he check in daily at DOC whilst he was homeless. He was engaged in treatment to the extent that he was able to pay for it, but despite remarkable efforts, he couldn't find a job and he could not come up with the means quickly enough to pay for his treatment.
Let me ask a question about efforts to obtain financing. And the record, I think, is a bit unclear. Mm-hmm. There was some suggestion that there was some kind of governmental benefits that might have been available if applied for.
He had applied for them, and I think that comes from the testimony of the jail services coordinator. He had applied for SSI. She testified that would be a few months before the state made the determination regarding eligibility, and then another several months before those benefits kicked in, but that once those benefits kicked in, he would receive a minimum of $697 per month.
Would that have been sufficient to cover the expense here?
Presumably so, yes. Obviously, he would still have had to obtain some form of housing, since the situation which he found himself, where essentially he wasn't allowed to live anywhere because of his status, would have had to have been addressed as well. But he took the first step, which was engaging in the psych eval. And I think what had happened earlier in the record, it was clear the court had wanted him to arrange for SSI or some other form of payment, state funding, whilst he was in jail. But while he was in jail, he couldn't actually make the application. He had to wait until his release from jail. He did that. He participated in the psychological evaluation, and then he applied for SSI benefits. Based upon his mental health diagnosis and, you know, the opinion of the jail services coordinator, there was no indication that he wouldn't have eventually qualified for those benefits.
So the issue here appears to be whether or not there has to be a determination of willfulness or not. And the cases clearly are the Supreme Court case, both U.S. and state Supreme Court. So why don't you address that issue?
Okay. And the willfulness question, I guess I would like to narrow the court's focus to the question of indigency in particular. And the issue, I think, in this case is whether the involuntary circumstance of a person's indigency can preclude that individual from receiving a benefit that is otherwise available to more wealthy persons in society. And I think that Bearden, to the extent that it talked about willfulness, made it clear that it's not permissible for the state to essentially punish someone for his poverty by denying him a benefit that he would otherwise obtain if he were more wealthy. And I think that's what happened here, because we have a young man whom, and I'll quote from Bearden, you know, Bearden said the decision to grant probation reflects a judicial determination that the state's penological interests do not require imprisonment. Here, similarly, the decision to grant a SOSA to Mr. Miller reflected a judicial determination that the community's interests and his interests would be served by him receiving community-based treatment.
What is the...
Yes, receiving community-based treatment.
Right.
Absent receiving community-based treatment, where are we?
Well, yeah. And that's why, I guess, okay, with regard to threat to the public safety, I'll start from there. I think it was wrong for the court to find that he posed a risk to reoffend without the treatment, given the track record where we have 3 years in the community after the offense before charges were filed without any kind of offending behavior, a year in which he's on his personal recognizance, and then checking in daily at DOC, checking in twice with jail services. So I think demonstrating his willingness, his intent to comply, and his low risk to reoffend. This is a guy who follows the rules that are set by the court. So I think the question that we come back to with regard to willfulness does come to a question of who should pay. And to the extent that the court correctly construed the statute at issue as barring SOSA treatment at public expense to those who, due to the involuntary circumstance of their indigency, are unable to participate, that statute violates equal protection. And I quoted in my brief from Williams versus in Illinois, in which the court held that essentially the statute works in invidious discrimination solely because he's unable to pay a fine. On its face, the statute extends to all defendants an apparently equal opportunity. In fact, this is an illusory choice for Williams or any other indigent who, by definition, is without funds. And that's exactly the situation where we have here, where essentially it's a pay-to-play system. If you can come up with the money to pay for the SOSA treatment and you're otherwise eligible, then you get the sentencing alternative. If, despite, and I think it's fair to characterize Mr. Miller's efforts as heroic efforts to really find the means to pay for it. He applied for 35 jobs. He was at WorkSource. He's at DVR. He obtains a food handler's permit. It's a bad economy. He's a sex offender. He can't find a job.
At sentencing, could the trial court have said, no SOSA, no prospects for being able to pay for it? Just not going to go there.
If that was the sole reason for denying the SOSA, I don't think that the court could have done that. I think that would have been a violation of equal protection at the outset. Bearden does say that the court can take into consideration a variety of circumstances, including financial resources, but here we have really a single circumstance. He doesn't have the money, and that's what the evaluator noted, and that's what the court noted at sentencing. But the court's position was a SOSA is not a right, it's a privilege. And we know from Morrissey that that distinction is an apposite when a person's liberty interest is at stake. And we know from Bearden, essentially, that it does violate due process, it violates the fundamental fairness, it violates, I would submit, the promise of equal access to justice to...
Well, he's had justice. The liberty is already severely compromised because he's been convicted. I mean, all of these analysis is spot on. We're dealing with a clean set of facts, but where you have a person who's been convicted by plea or otherwise of the crimes, and he is the sex offender. Well, if so facto, I think is really where we are with respect to public safety, not necessarily an individual inquiry.
May I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. In Morrissey, those are probationers who've been convicted of a crime or parolees who've been convicted of a crime, but the court nevertheless held that the conditional liberty interest at stake was sufficiently great to afford the analysis that I'm putting forward to the court. And it's a similar situation as well in Bearden and Williams. Those are all convicted individuals. Thank you.
You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Eric Ohm representing the state, the respondent in this matter. Your Honors, in January 2011, Mr. Miller entered a guilty plea to rape of a child in the first degree. He argued for and was granted a SOSA sentence by the court. The court was reticent from the get-go to grant the SOSA to Mr. Miller. The court was concerned not only about where he would live, but also particularly how he would do treatment, how he would be able to pay for treatment. Mr. Miller's family indicated that they would help pay. The judge instructed Mr. Miller, you need to start now in lining up any social money, any entitlements he might be entitled to.
I think we know all this.
Okay, sorry.
Could the court have denied the SOSA from the get-go?
The court has very broad discretion in granting or denying a SOSA if they think the person's a bad candidate based on their inability to do treatment
to pay?
Or pay. I think they could say no. I mean, he's entered a guilty plea to rape of a child in the first degree. If the court sees he's going to fail, it would be the court's duty to say, no, you're not a good candidate. You're going to get the standard range sentence. You're not going to get the SOSA.
So with respect to what's presently before us, the revocation, that's an abuse of discretion standard.
Correct.
And the argument here is that it is an abuse because of the indigency of Miller. I'll ask you the same question that I asked your opponent, and that is willfulness required here as a part of that analysis by the trial court?
Willfulness is not required here, and that's based on the analysis that we compare under the due process analysis. You look at the individual interests of the state, and you look at the individual interest of the of Mr. Miller in this case. Mr. Miller's interest is only being violated or revoked from his SOSA based on a willful act, whereas the state's interest is protecting society from a convicted sex offender, convicted child rapist, protecting children from a convicted child rapist that is out in society but not being treated. One of the things I was trying to get to was that the court, when it revoked the SOSA, the facts came out that at the soonest Mr. Miller could get money for treatment, be that from SSI or whatever source, would have been 9 months from the date that the court revoked the SOSA. So it would have been an entire year since he finished his local 12 months in jail until he would have.
Bearden, on which your opponent relies, talks about this subject, and footnote 9 may have some relevance here. Can you address footnote 9 in the context of what we're talking about here?
Footnote 9, that would, if I'm not mistaken, Your Honor, that is that talk about the dangerousness of somebody?
Yes.
Okay. So that's saying, Bearden, my reading of Bearden was that the court can't automatically revoke somebody for failure to pay a fine. They can revoke somebody for failure to pay a fine, but they have to go through an analysis, and that's whether or not they made bona fide efforts. If yes, were there alternatives to confinement available? And if yes, then the court has to balance the interests of the parties against each other. The court in Bearden said, and if I'm remembering correctly, said that this wouldn't foreclose us from, say, violating somebody because they keep driving under the influence when they're ordered not to. In the Bearden court, which is threshed out more by the state court opinions here, is that if the violation itself creates a danger to society, then the finding of willfulness is not required, and that's what the court concluded in the Rathall case.
That if but doesn't that beg the question where the violation occurs, I mean, maybe that is a factual question we don't know the answer to, that occurred today this morning, that not that we can't see what would be apparent, but nevertheless not in our jurisdiction to make that determination. But let's assume that his circumstances all relate to his poverty and his indigency, and that's the reason there is a violation. In other words, that analysis only goes that far when then you run right up against the Morrissey analysis, the equal protection argument. Has that been obviated by Bearden?
I think the society must be protected. The state has a very strong interest in that, and that outweighs any interest in. I think in this case it's important to see that this was not a fine that he didn't pay. This was not like Bearden, where people were placed in jail and then they could for not paying a fine. That was a sort of a first offender type case where people could not go to jail if they paid a fine. The person in Bearden lost his job, so he then wasn't able to make his payments and he was automatically thrown in jail, and the decision really says you have to at least learn all the facts and balance some things before you do that. We're not saying you can't do that, but you have to balance things. You can't just automatically do it. That's how I read Bearden. In this case, Mr. Miller was not violated for, excuse me, not paying a fine. He was revoked for not being in treatment. Yes, that had to do with money, but it was not a fine. When you don't pay a fine, that itself doesn't create a danger to society. Your not having money on its own does not create a safety issue. But in this case, you're not having money and thereby not paying for treatment itself creates a safety issue. And the scales of the interests of the parties weighs heavily to the state, I would argue, in that case.
Within that due process analysis, it wouldn't be a, I'm not sure we know the answer.
Well, if we look at the appellant does make the equal protection arguments, and sometimes they're a little bit meshed.
Well, in fact, Bearden appears to merge due process and equal protection analysis for whatever reason.
Right. The appellant cites to William v. Illinois in their equal protection argument. That case is not on point in my reading. It's not the same as Mr. Miller's case. In William v. Illinois, the state was keeping prisoners beyond the statutory maximum in that case if they couldn't pay their fines on their day of release. So they were saying, can you pay your fine? No. Oh, you can't? Okay, so you can work it off at $5 a day, I believe was the rate. So and the court, in its opinion, said this is a narrow opinion. We're not getting rid of every disparity between somebody that has money and somebody that doesn't have money. In the opinion, they said this would not get rid of a sentencing scheme such as you can have 30 days in jail or you can pay $30. Certainly that would have a huge disparate impact on people whether they had $30 or didn't have $30. And the court in that case said this doesn't affect that. It was very narrowly tailored because the court was doing indirectly what they couldn't do directly, i.e. keeping people beyond the statutory maximum.
Even if Bearden did apply and we did have a willfulness analysis, can you address the second part of that and respond to the argument that we don't have a showing of adequate risk to reoffend here so that incarceration is the only option?
I think there is a very strong showing that there's a risk to reoffend. We have somebody who's been convicted of raping a child in the first degree, a very young child. The court looked at the assessment of Mr. Miller and it indicated that he was very high on some of these risk factors. When they said he's moderate to low, that was assuming that he had a stable place to live, which he did not. That was assuming also that he was in intensive sex offender treatment at the time. So to say, well, he's low to moderate, that's putting a blindfold onto the actual facts of the case, because he was in the beginning, he was living under a bridge. It was on the front page of the paper, and people were up in arms about it. He had no place to live. The only reason he was able to get these places where he could couch surf was with the help of the Department of Corrections finding him these places that were definitely not ideal, and they indicated they wouldn't normally have allowed somebody to live there, but it was better than living under a bridge or living in a park. So this was not the case where it was an off-the-cuff decision that these cases argue against. The court was very careful in giving Mr. Miller as much time as the court felt it could give him and not endanger the safety of the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Judge Gross's hypothetical of Mr. Miller's situation being due solely to his poverty is in fact true. The facts support it. The facts fully support it. Mr. Miller was not failing to engage in treatment. He was receiving $197 a month from GAU, and he was applying the full amount towards treatment. His treatment provider indicated that he was willing to continue with him at that frequency until additional payments came through. It was the court's decision to revoke him. I think as far as the willfulness question, the state's attempting to throw open the floodgates. Certainly the hypothetical posed in Bearden of the person who is unable to control his drunken driving and violates his probation by continuing to drive, or as in Rathel, a person who is conceitedly a high risk to reoffend without these additional sort of stabilizing factors, is different fundamentally and at its base from a person who where indigency itself is not a threat to the safety of society. And so we don't have an alternative of Mr. Miller going in the community without treatment. We have to look at the statutory framework, and the framework itself encourages this unconstitutional result by essentially saying, tough luck, Mr. Miller, if you can't pay, you can't play. There's another alternative, which is this court can read into the statute an obligation upon the state to require the state to pay for treatment for those who due to the involuntary circumstance of their indigency, can't afford it. Or this court can, as I've ask this court to do, hold the statute unconstitutional as it is applied to my client. So it's not a simple situation of if he can't pay for treatment, then he's going to be roaming around the community preying upon people. This is a situation where simply because of his poverty, simply and solely because of his poverty, he cannot avail himself of this right, essentially, that is afforded to those who are more wealthy. If he were, you know, if he were a Boeing engineer and in every other way identical, we would not be here today. As far as the liberty interest, he went to prison for 93 months to life at a cost of some $47,000 a year to the state. The cost of paying for his treatment would have been around $6,700 per year. And that's assuming, you know, he can never pay for treatment. At some point, we have to assume the SSI benefits will kick in. And DOC, in fact, does pay for treatment where the person was a minor at the time that the charges were filed. And that's in 994A670 sub 14. So it's, I don't think, as simple as the state's trying to make it out. It's not a question of we let him roam free untreated. I think the court does appropriately consider the risk to reoffend. Here that risk was low, and here the denial, the revocation violated due process and equal protection. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is